Well, just before coming to Sichuan, Kathy and I were in New York, where our children and grandchildren live. And so our visits to New York are complicated because our sons and daughters-in-law are very busy people with complicated lives. So while we were there, one was in Slovenia on an artist residency. One had to go to Boulder, Colorado to take a deposition in a legal case. One of them was in either the Netherlands or Germany, I don't know, wherever they have this art festival called Documenta, wherever that is, he was there. So we had serious child care duties to attend to. It was a little complicated. There were pickups from the nannies and from schools and skateboard camp and other lessons. And we worked very hard. It's quite hard, actually, work to take care of little children. But, of course, we like it a lot. And Kathy had to do a lot more of it than me because I was only there for 3 whole days. And I had to come home because I had a retreat that I had scheduled. My family members don't schedule on an 18-month to 2-year window like I do, so I often have this problem. They need me and I need to be somewhere else at the same time. So at one point we were had picked up our grandson after skateboard class. And we were at some little Chinese restaurant, not a restaurant, little kind of like hole-in-the-wall place, having something to drink. And then one of us had to rush back to the other household to pick up our granddaughter, whose nanny was dropping her off. So I was the one assigned to take, it was a very long walk from where we were at the Chinese place to the other house. So I had a long walk across Brooklyn. And to tell you the truth, I was very happy to have a little peace. Just me walking for some period of time, maybe a 45-minute walk or something. So I had a wonderful time. Now you have your phone with you all the time, so you see. There are amazing buildings and things to see in Brooklyn, so I was taking a lot of pictures. But then I was admiring the sparrows. You know, who notices sparrows? But there's sparrows all over the place. Such great birds, so simple. Straightforward, so game, you know, no pretense with a sparrow. Scrappy. They get into everything. They'll be there at the restaurant, you know. If you're sitting on a table outside, there'll be sparrows all around you. Little nondescript brown birds that probably nobody notices. But there, I think there's a line in the Gospels, right, about sparrows, isn't there? I think there's a gospel song about sparrows. Yeah. Keeps his eyes are on the sparrow. Yeah, right. That's right. So I like sparrows. And when I was walking along, one of these thoughts came over me that often lead to years of trouble. I thought to myself, I think that I'll write a long poem, maybe about 150 pages long, about sparrows. I thought, oh no, I hope I get rid of that thought. You don't hear about sparrows that much around here, but in Japan, you know, they love sparrows. It's a whole, like, special art form, painting sparrows. Maybe it's the Zen influence, you know, on Japanese culture that makes them like sparrows. And then as I was walking along contemplating sparrows, and watching them, I thought of William Carlos Williams' great poem about sparrows. And again, you know, we live in these wonderful times. I could like take out my phone and immediately I could read Williams' great poem about sparrows. This is the poem, The Sparrow. This sparrow who comes to sit at my window is a poetic truth, more than a natural one. His voice, his movements, his habits, how he loves to flutter his wings in the dust, all attested. Granted, he does it to rid himself of lice, but the relief he feels makes him cry out lustily, which is a trait more related to music than otherwise. Wherever he finds himself in early spring, on back streets or beside palaces, he carries on unaffectedly his amours. It begins in the egg. The sex genders it. What is more pretentiously useless, or about which we more pride ourselves? It leads, as often as not, to our undoing. The cockerel, the crow, with their challenging voices, cannot surpass the insistence of his cheep. Once at El Paso, toward evening, I saw and heard 10,000 sparrows who had come in from the desert to roost. They filled the trees of a small park. Men fled with ears ringing from their droppings, leaving the premises to the alligators who inhabit the fountain. His image is familiar as that of the aristocratic unicorn. A pity there are not more oats eaten nowadays to make living easier for him. At that, his small size, keen eyes, serviceable beak, and general truculence assure his survival, to say nothing of his innumerable brood. Even the Japanese know him and have painted him sympathetically with profound insight into his minor characteristics. Nothing even remotely subtle about his lovemaking. He crouches before the female, drags his wings, waltzing, throws back his head, and simply yells. The din is terrific. The way he swipes his bill across a plank to clean it is decisive. So with everything he does. His coppery eyebrows give him the air of being always a winner. And yet, I saw once the female of his species clinging determinatively to the edge of a water pipe, catch him by his crown feathers to hold him silent, subdued, hanging above the city streets until she was through with him. What was the use of that? She hung there herself, puzzled at her success. I laughed heartily. Practical to the end, it is the poem of his existence that triumphed finally. A wisp of feathers flattened to the pavement, wings spread symmetrically as if in flight, the head gone, the black escutcheon of the breast undecipherable. An effigy of a sparrow, a dried wafer only, left to say, and it says it without offense, beautifully. This was I, a sparrow. I did my best. Farewell. Well, that poem really holds up, I think. They don't all hold up, but that one holds up. And I hadn't read it for a number of years, you know, I don't know how many, quite a few. And I noticed this time many things that I failed to notice when I read it years ago. For instance, the reference to oats, I don't know if you caught that, but Dr. Williams grew up when he was young, you know, the typical means of local transportation was horse and buggy. You know, he was born in the late 1880s, I think, right? So there were no cars, and so everybody had horses around and lots of oats. So the sparrows always had plenty to eat. I also completely missed the outrageous identification that he's making here with the sparrow. Anyway, how does he know it's a male sparrow? You know, maybe it's a female sparrow. He's talking as if, oh yeah, of course it's a male sparrow. I don't know that you can actually tell too easily. Maybe you can. I'm not a birder, so I don't know. Anyway, he assumes it's a male sparrow. And also, he outrageously projects his own randiness onto the sparrow. You know, I don't know that the sparrow was so concerned with lovemaking as Dr. Williams was. And there's no doubt in my mind that the female clinging to the edge of a water pipe and holding onto the startled sparrow above by his crown feathers, dangling him over the city streets, is William's wife, Flossie, who actually did hold him in that way, you know, keeping him tethered to earth and keeping him from falling and breaking his head, as he probably would have if she did not take charge of him, despite his many, many, often catastrophic infidelities. And at the end of his life, he wrote the most tender and wonderful poems of appreciation for her constancy. But it is the end of the poem that I think is the most spectacular, isn't it? The poor flattened sparrow, squelched, no doubt, by a car on the street. You've seen this, you know, like a flat wafer, as he says. And yet, still, at least in William's ear, still talking. This was I, a sparrow. I did my best. Farewell. Gotta love that. Don't you want to have that written on your tombstone? This was I, a sparrow. I did my best. Farewell. So, to me, sparrows are the bodhisattvas of birds. Plain and simple, totally persistent, fully resilient, and absolutely unstoppable. Probably when there are no more human beings around, there will be sparrows galore, eating all the cockroaches and other bugs that are around. They're everywhere, but you often don't notice them. And even when they're flattened, and they keep on singing their bodhisattva songs. So, the retreat that I had to come home for was the first of two retreats that I'm going to do this summer with the great Danny Matt, who is a scholar, possibly one of the two great scholars living, two greatest scholars of Jewish mysticism, along with Elliot Wolfson. But Danny has the signal achievement of having been the translator of the Zohar, the 13th century classic of Jewish mysticism. It took him more than 20 years of labor to do this work. He started it when he was a professor at the Theological Seminary in Berkeley, and he realized that he was not going to live long enough to complete the work, so some wealthy person gave him enough endowment so that he could quit his job and spend the next maybe 10 or 15 years doing nothing else but sitting at his desk translating the Zohar, an immense work. One of the guys at the Everyday Zen group in the Bay Area gave me a gift of the Zohar text in Danny Matt's English translation. 12 volumes. 12 volumes of intensity that fill an entire shelf in my study. Big, fat, bright yellow dust jackets. 12 of them, this thick each. So somehow or other we are doing some retreats together, and he said, what should we call these retreats? And I said, I know what we should call them. We should call them from the Seinfeld show, About Nothing. You know, what's your show about? Oh, it's about nothing. So that was the name of our retreat, About Nothing. And yesterday I was talking about nothing. That's what I usually talk about, nothing. And how important nothing is in this world of so many, many, many somethings which become oppressive after a while. Maybe you've noticed. Because there's something not quite right about these many somethings. There's something missing in these many somethings. And of course, what's missing is nothing. Nothing is missing. So, this is just to say that Buddhists are not the only ones who like nothing. Jewish mystics also have a taste for it. The Buddha sutras seem to rattle on at some length about nothing, somehow explaining nothing, but not explaining nothing at all. But the Jewish mystics are absolutely in love. I don't think that's saying too much. In love with nothing. They're singing songs to nothing. They're ranting and raving about nothing. And a lot of what they say will sound very familiar to us. The Zohar is a sort of notoriously esoteric text. That's why Danny's translation is so extensive, because he gives huge numbers of footnotes that are really, really good, so that it's actually possible with his useful notes to understand what would it seem at first seem to be completely obscure. So for this retreat that we had, Danny came with some short paragraphs of text, not from the Zohar, but other things, so that we could have a conversation about nothing. So this morning I thought I would share a few of these really wonderful teachings from Jewish mysticism with you. So here's the first one. This one is actually written by, it's a little excerpt from something written by Moses de Leon, who is the most likely the author of the Zohar. The Zohar, he actually went to the trouble of writing it in Aramaic so that he could pretend that it had been written in the second century by a famous rabbi, and always claimed that it was this second century text that he discovered. But scholars now are almost 100% certain that he was the author of it himself in the 13th century, using this archaic language. Anyway, this is not from the Zohar, this is some other thing, text he wrote. The first Svira is the sum of all existence, and all have wearied in their search for it. The belt of the wise is burst open by this mysterious cause of causes. Svira is a sort of part of it. Comes from the esoteric mystical system of the Zohar and other Kabbalistic writings. The first Svira is I, nothingness. The first svira is the sum of all existence, and all have wearied in their search for it. The belt of the wise is burst by this mysterious cause of causes. It's kind of wonderful that they think that you contemplate the spherot in your belly. And it's so impossible that you burst your belt, you know, because your belly just pops open from contemplation. Arouse yourself to contemplation, to focus thought. For God is the annihilation of all thoughts, uncontainable by any concept. Indeed, since no one can contain God at all, it is called ayin, nothingness. And this is the secret of the verse, v'hachochma me'ayin timatze, which means wisdom comes into being out of ayin, which is a quote from Job. Everything must be proven by scripture, so there's always a quote. Anything sealed and concealed, totally unknown to anyone, is called ayin, meaning that no one knows anything about it. Similarly, no one knows anything about the human soul. She stands in the status of nothingness, as it is written. The superiority of the human over the beast is ayin, nothing. By means of this soul, the human being attains the glory of nothing, of ayin. So, I think this is such a great teaching. The Kabbalists, like all other rabbis throughout history, believe that the Torah was written in code, that clearly it wasn't saying what it appeared to be saying. It was saying something else, and one had to discover what it was. Because the Torah is secret and hidden. And that's one of the big themes of Jewish mysticism, the hiddenness, the concealment of reality in this world. Because nothing is hidden everywhere you look in all of the somethings. So the God of the Torah, who seems to be a not entirely appealing character in the text, is not really that. It's concealing something beyond that. It's concealing ayin, nothing. And he's saying, and the human soul has within it the same nothing. The same point of nothingness is concealed in the middle of the human soul. It's not that we are God or have God within us, it's that we are nothingness in exactly the same way that God is nothing. And this is what I was saying yesterday in other language. When we get in touch with our essential humanness, beyond the entanglement of our personality, and yet our personality is expressive, when we get in touch with that, we are liberated from ourselves. We become nothing, and therefore are free. We go beyond ourselves, because that's who we really are. This is our true self, our original self, as we would say in Zen, is the self expressed through the self that's beyond the self. And then it's actually, you might not appreciate the humor in this teaching from Ecclesiastes, where he quotes, I guess I didn't give the citation, that when it says, the superiority of the human over the beast is I and nothing. That's a quote from Ecclesiastes, chapter 3, verse 19. And So it's actually quite funny because the way that the mystics and most rabbis actually read, especially the mystics, the way they read the Torah is a little bit the way poets read text, with lots of intentional accidents and mistakes and misreadings and twists. Ecclesiastes, they say, was supposed to be written by Solomon when he was old. Solomon was also the author of the Song of Songs, which he wrote, they say, when he was young. Song of Songs, which is, you can't believe this is in the Bible, you know, the Song of Songs. It's the most outrageous romantic, sexual love poem in history. Every other love poem, including pop songs, all have their source in the Song of Songs. He wrote that when he was young. Of course, the mystics totally see that this is nothing to do with sexual love. It's all about divine love, which is probably, in the end, the same thing, right? Anyway, in Middle Age, they say, he wrote Proverbs, a text of sober, mature wisdom. Good advice, you know, sober, balanced advice. But at the end of his life, he wrote Ecclesiastes, which is famous for its disillusionment with the things of the world. An old person looking at the world and saying, ugh. I'm there already, you know. What a mess, you know, what a mess. Ecclesiastes, you all know this, it says, you know, vanity of vanity, everything is vanity. What's the use of any of this stuff, you know? It's all vanity. In other words, this is an old person's lament over the sad world. Anyway, in the passage quoted, Solomon is writing about how pathetic we are, we human beings. He's saying, you know, we think we're so great. We think that all the things we do are important, and we're so superior to the beasts and the animals. But what's the difference between us and the animals? Nothing at all. That's what he's saying. So Moses de Leon takes this and reads it in the opposite, the same, but the opposite way. What's the difference between us and the animals? Nothing. And this is nothing is what makes us great. This is our great claim to fame in the species in the animal kingdom, of the animal kingdom. We are nothing, and we know it. It's our sense of despair, our fear of death, the possibility that each one of us has that our life could be absolutely meaningless. No other animal could live a meaningless life, only us, which is why we have to find meaning. It's our very fragility that comes from our thinking and our conceptual elaboration that connects us to endless divinity. This is actually quite similar to our feeling in the Bodhisattva path, in which we do not leap over our suffering and the suffering of the world into transcendence and blissful rest. Instead, we face our suffering. We understand it fully, and in doing so, we taste our truest and most joyful life. So there's a third, a short paragraph from this same teaching. That which abides in thought, yet cannot be grasped, is called chokhmah, wisdom. What is the meaning of chokhmah? Chakeh ma. Wait for what? Since you can never grasp it, chakeh, wait for Ma, what will come and what will be. This is the sublime primordial wisdom emerging out of I am. So this is even more fabulous to me. And this is how they do things, you know. He breaks up the word chokhmah into two parts, just cuts it in half. And it becomes the words chakeh and ma, right? Chokhmah becomes chakeh and ma. Ma is my all-time favorite Hebrew word. It's a great word. It means what. What. And chakeh means to wait. So that's what wisdom is. Wait for what? If anybody says, what's wisdom? That's the definition of wisdom. Wait for what? And this is completely true. The wisdom of Prajna Paramita, as we studied yesterday, is not knowing something. Because there's literally nothing to know. As soon as we know something and have something, we know we're off the mark. So Prajna Paramita, wisdom beyond wisdom, is not knowing something. It's a presence with, a waiting with. And waiting is very beautiful and very important. Not waiting for, but simply waiting with. When we practice Prajna Paramita, we are waiting with life, waiting with presence, as if every moment were full and pregnant with our waiting. What are we waiting for? Right. We're waiting for what? What we are waiting for. For whatever will be. For whatever will happen. And before it happens, you never know what will happen. You can't know. Every moment is really like this. Every moment is full of possibility. Every moment, every living moment is full of what will be that is not yet. And so it's what. But that what is here right now in each moment. To be alive to this endless possibility of unknowing, which is wonder, which is growth, that exists in every moment. This is really how our lives are, and this is wisdom, to live our life in that way. There's a very famous passage in the Torah where Moses says to God, you gotta tell me your name. Because when I go to the Egyptians and I say, you know, God told you to let my people free, if I don't have a name for you, then they're gonna say, you know, kick me out. So you gotta tell me your name. So God says, okay, my name is Ehyeh Asher Ehyeh. And nobody knows exactly what that means, but usually they say it means I am what I am. Or simultaneously it means I will be what I will be. That's the deepest meaning of what is the Absolute. Being is like that. It's always and only exactly what it is, and not otherwise. And it always and only goes on. Being always includes a what in it. An unknown future that will be, always. And that's why when we practice intimacy with ourselves, as we do in Sesshin, or when we practice intimacy as the Jewish mystics would practice intimacy with the divine, by virtue of that practice, we would always have a hopeful heart. We would understand that times will be bright, that times will be dark, but we will always have a hopeful heart because we would know that life, being as it is inherently hope. That's what hope is. It's life. That's the nature of life, of being. Somebody said to me the other day that they thought emptiness sounds a little cold. It didn't make them feel too fuzzy and warm when they heard about emptiness. But it's the opposite. Emptiness, I am nothing, is hope. It's endless hope. It's joy. It's awesomeness. Because something is going to happen and you never know what it is. You can't know. That's the nature of being, is that we don't know. That's the nothing part. So here's another teaching. This is from a little bit later. De Leon was in the 13th century. This is a little bit later from the Hasidic tradition, which was the next iteration of Jewish mysticism. This is a teaching by Rabbi Baer of Zlotchov. The essence of serving God and all the mitzvot, all the commandments, is to attain the state of humility. Namely, to understand that all your physical and mental powers and your essential being depend on the divine elements within. You are simply a channel for the divine qualities. You attain this humility through the awe of God's vastness, through realizing that there is no place empty of God. Then you come to the state of I am, of nothing, of humility. You have no independent self and are contained, as it were, in the Creator. And this is the meaning of the verse, because there's always got to be a verse, you know. Moses hid his face, for he was in awe. Exodus 3:6. Through his experience of awe, Moses attained the hiding of his face. That is, he perceived no independent self. Everything was part of divinity. So, humility is becoming nothing. So I'll tell you a Jewish joke. I probably told you this before. It's a pretty famous joke. You probably heard it. But jokes are good when you repeat them over and over again, right? So this is the one about Yom Kippur. You know this joke. It's Yom Kippur, the Day of Atonement, when you're supposed to, like, humiliate yourself, literally, you know, become really sort of recognize what a sinner you are and all this. So you're really supposed to, it's like mandated, you're supposed to feel bad about yourself on this day, and everybody's going around feeling really, really bad about themselves. And so the president of the rabbi, first the rabbi gets up in the front of everybody and he says, "Ah, it's Yom Kippur, I'm such a horrible person, I'm nothing, I'm nobody, oh, I feel so awful." And then the president of the synagogue, major fundraiser, comes forth and says, "Oh, me too, I'm nothing, I'm nobody, I'm so awful, I'm just a sinner, it's terrible." And he sits down. And then the guy who opens the synagogue, you know, and like is paid a little bit of money, doesn't have any other job, he opens the synagogue, sweeps up and everything, he's sitting way in the back, and he's so like moved by this that he runs up in the front, "I too am nothing, I'm nobody, oh." And the rabbi says to the president of the congregation, "Hey, look who thinks he's nobody." Some of you apparently haven't heard this joke. Well, you hear it, you'll hear it again next year. So humility might be the most important and most profound of all spiritual practices. These days, you know, nobody preaches humility much. because it's a rather pedestrian virtue, you know, to be modest and humble, not to... Now we all have to market ourselves. We can't be afford to be humble, you know. We have to tell everybody how great we are, constantly on LinkedIn and everything. So humility is quite bad for business. Plus, we live in this age of, you know, egotism and self-esteem accumulation and the epidemic of, you know, toxic self-denigration. So who cares about humility? It seems like a bad idea. But here we learn of the deeper meaning of the practice of humility. Humility understood on a totally different basis. To be humble is not to put yourself down, "Oh, shucks, you know, I ain't nothing." It means understanding that your essential being and all your powers depend on the divine elements. That you on your own, as a separate being with talents and skills, might not be much. But the truth is, you are a channel for the divine energy, or as we might say, you are the voice, the hands and eyes of the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas. And this is exactly what I was trying to say the other day. You know, your life really is not your own. It never has been your own. Yes, you have to make effort, but what happens? What and who you are and will be is really not your business. This is what I meant when I was saying that yesterday. You realize that the more you know yourself, the more you know who you really are, the more you are free of the burden of yourself. The more you realize that your life is the expression of another and is lived in the service of another. And that is such a brilliant thing. It's such a joyful thing. And that's the actual practice of humility that's being pointed to in this teaching. So you can be quite realistic about yourself. There's nobody in this room who doesn't have a lot of things to appreciate about themselves and a lot of shortcomings that you could name about yourself. We're all in that boat. And we could appreciate all of that. There's good news and there's bad news always in being you. And that's all perfect. And beyond that, there's your true self, your real self. That your ordinary self is meant to convey. Your ups and your downs both express her wonder. Your triumphs and your defeats equally express her beauty. So I have one last short one I'll share. This one is by another Hasidic Rebbe, Dov Baer. And I bring this one up because it's such a beautiful practice for Sesshin. It's quite amazing, actually. When you gaze at an object, you bring blessing to it. For through contemplation, you know that it is really absolutely nothing without divinity permeating it, this object. Is absolutely nothing without divinity permeating it. By means of this awareness, you draw greater vitality to that object from the divine source of life, since you bind that thing to absolute I am, the origin of all. On the other hand, if you look at that object as a separate thing, by your look, that thing is cut off from its divine root and vitality. Isn't that an astonishing thought? Dove Bear seems to be actually saying that when we, through our practice, we can't just make this up, but through our practice over time, when we really understand who we are and what our life is, we might say, when you really begin to practice prajnaparamita and fully appreciate the empty and boundless connected nature of all dharmas, then your very acts of perception, and maybe we could certainly include your speaking, your actions, actually wake up the world. He's saying that through our practice, we actually have the power to bring the world to life. He's literally saying that looking at an object, gazing at the face of another human being, with eyes of wisdom, with eyes of love, we bring blessing to that object or person. And this is our job as practitioners, to bring blessings to the world. Change the world. Wake the world up. That's an amazing thought, that we have that power. It goes without saying that we can't think that we have this power. Oh, look at me, I pretty much changed everybody's life just by walking around today. I mean, it's ridiculous, right, to objectify this as a personal power. And if we did that, it would immediately disappear, of course, because it would not be inspired by true humility, by nothingness. And we would inevitably create disturbance and trouble. But if we just simply lived that way, saw things that way, fully understood and felt that each and everything really does have its root in Buddha mind, that each and every thing and person really is permeated by divinity, then in our interactions with that thing or person through perception, through action, we would actually be returning to that thing or person its true birthright. And when we do the reverse of that, when we see things, as he says, with eyes of fear and separation, then we're cutting things off from their true root. And unfortunately, this is our world, right? This is how we relate to one another. We are constantly cutting each other off from our divinity, from the truth of our sacredness. We do not go through this world interacting sacred being. This is not what's going on, right? The opposite is going on. And this is why we have so much pain and suffering. This is why the world is so painfully difficult. And we see others as sacred, and we see ourselves as sacred too. And just as we diminish others, we diminish ourselves when we view ourselves through a critical and needy lens. So I bring this up in session because we could actually practice this in session. We could train our hearts in practicing exactly this. Pay attention to your looking, to your seeing. And try to see things with soft eyes, loving eyes. Practice literally the act of visual perception with a sense of inclusion, a sense of softness and wideness without boundaries. And with a sense of really feeling that whatever your eyes light on is perfect, is divine, is exactly as it should be. And we're lucky because it's not too hard to do that around here, where every face you see will be beautiful. And all the surroundings that you see will be beautiful. So it's a good place to train yourself in this kind of scene. But if you can do it here, then you can do it anywhere. You can do it in Brooklyn. You can do it in the big city.
Everything.
Even the terrible things is noble. Even a squashed sparrow on the sidewalk is noble. It's singing. It's life song. And everyone with ears, with real ears, can hear. So a few more lines from Prajnaparamita Sutra, and then I'm finished. Forms are not wisdom, nor is wisdom found in form, in consciousness, perceptions, feelings, or in will. They are not wisdom, for no wisdom is in them. Like space it is, without a break or crack. Of all objective supports, the essential original nature is boundless. Of beings, likewise, the essential original nature is boundless. As the essential original nature of space has no limits, just so the wisdom of the world knowers is boundless. Perceptions, mere words, so the leaders have told us, perceptions forsaken and gone, and the door is open to the beyond. Those who succeed in ridding themselves of perceptions, they, having reached the beyond, fulfill the teacher's commandments. If for eons countless as the sands of the Ganges, the leader would himself continue to pronounce the word being, still, pure from the very start, no being could ever result from his speaking. This is the practice of wisdom, the highest perfection. So, we're all working pretty hard this week on our practice. And that's great. We need to keep doing that. We should make a big, big effort, because life is always making effort. But the truth is, there's nothing to this practice. Nothing at all. It's wonderful. So, I guess that some of you will be leaving today, right?
Tomorrow.
So they'll be here tomorrow morning. Yeah, okay, so we'll say goodbye then. So thank you for listening, and let's please keep on going. The trick of strong effort, total ease, because there's nothing to do. Right? That's what we have to learn to do. We can learn it here, and then we can practice it all the time. So, onward, let's do one more day and see what happens. Thank you very much.